If you're only sitting in a corporate office and you're looking at data, but you don't have any context of what's happening in the field or on the ground, you're not going to be very effective. And so that's something that I'm always deliberate about when I start a new role, is I want to spend my first 90 days in the field. I want to be with people. I want to be in the manufacturing centers or the fulfillment centers, distribution centers, and actually just observing, because there's so much power that comes from walking a floor. You don't have to talk to anybody, but just walking around, you're going to be able to understand, okay, the dynamics. Is leadership engaged there with their shop floor associates? I can typically tell within 5 minutes if there's good engagement between leadership and shop floor associates just by walking around and how they interact with one another.
Absolutely.
Highly important. Highly important.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Ben.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Welcome to another edition of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, my guest is Ben Cook. Ben is the Chief Supply Chain Officer for Spreetel, a full-service e-commerce accelerator and 3PL provider. Ben is an experienced, hands-on, people-focused leader with a passion for serving others and becoming the best versions of themselves, and helping to create strong values-based cultures where high-performing teams master change and execute the vision for their next phase of the company's life. He has held senior leadership roles at Apple, the Home Depot, and Kimberly-Clark, as well as two startup ventures, and has served on the board of advisors for several startup companies, the Auburn University College of Business, and the University of Tennessee's Global Supply Chain Institute. Ben is also a United States Army Special Operations veteran and is an avid outdoorsman and adventurer who can be found frequently hiking and camping in the Colorado wilderness. Welcome, Ben. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I've been chasing you. You rascally rabbit, you are. I've been chasing you for the better part of a year. So, I really appreciate you taking the time. But you've been a traveling bone. You've had a couple of projects over the last couple of years, a couple of positions that have taken you hither and there.
You bet.
So, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you have an interesting story, which is why I invited you in the first place. I mean, I looked at, your early career. I've looked at some of the positions that you've held. You seem to be knee deep in supply chain. So why don't we take it from the beginning? Well, maybe not, you know, your infancy, but, you know, when you could start recalling memories and whatnot. So how did Ben become Ben?
Yeah, it's been a journey for sure. I was born in North Carolina. My father was in the military, and we lived there all of 2 or 3 months. And he decided to get out of the military because he didn't want to travel all the time with a newborn. Something he and my mom just made a decision on. And then he decided to become a high school football coach in the Southeast, which ended up traveling quite a bit because he was always saying he was either getting fired or promoted every 2 years. So it seemed like our average tenure anywhere growing up was about 2 years, a couple of stops for 3 years. So I grew up traveling throughout the Southeast. So today, when anyone asks where I'm from, it's hard for me to answer that because I've never really lived anywhere more than a few years, at least growing up. So we moved around quite a bit. I'd say a pivotal time in my life was in high school. We moved to Spain for 2 years. My dad was doing nonprofit work in Africa, and we lived in southern Spain. So I had a chance to go to an international school. I was one of only a handful of Americans at the school. So most of my classmates were from Europe or from the Middle East. And so for me, it gave me exposure to a lot of things that a lot of my peers in the States didn't have exposure to. And I got to travel all over Europe. My dad took me to multiple trips into North Africa to help him with some of his NGO work. So it was, I don't think I realized how valuable those lessons were then until years later when I got into business and started dealing with, you know, people from different cultures, backgrounds, and countries. And, I definitely think that was a highly pivotal point in my life.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's when I'm meeting people, even in Germany here, the people that have spent time abroad have a completely different view of the world than those people that have, you know, stayed, you know, basically within their country their entire lives. I mean, they have no clue what's going on outside the world, or no, it can't resonate with them. You know what I mean? It's it's almost like, you know, watching a fantasy film rather than reality. And, you know, not to get on a tangent here, but the, you know, the news services in the States don't do any justice either. I mean, you know, even the Weather Channel, did you ever see the Weather Channel? There's never any weather in Canada. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, they show the clouds and everything else, but once it reaches the Canadian border, it's like nothing. It's so, you know, so it's rather sad. So, yeah. So you, you probably learned Spanish then when you were in Spain.
I did. Yeah. I'd say I was conversationally fluent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The funny thing about language is if you don't use it, you lose it, at least in my experience. So, I actually, at one point was semi-fluent Spanish and also French. Today, if I were to go to France, I'd struggle to get by with my French. I can fumble through on Spanish, but I still mess up the verbs and stuff like that, but I can get by. You know, I've traveled to Spain every couple of years and, went down to Costa Rica about 3 years ago and got by perfectly fine down there. It probably sounded, little, elementary, but it worked.
Okay. So I got to give you a confession here. I've been in Germany for 12 years.
Okay.
I can't speak it or read it.
German's a tough language, though, I will say.
It is tough, but here I am. I'm in Frankfurt. When I came here, I had every intent of learning German. All right. I had the Rosetta Stone and everything. Yeah. But there are two types of Germans that I came across. Mm-hmm. The one type, as soon as I spoke German, they would switch it to English. Mm-hmm. I mean, immediately. And the second type would proceed to correct me with everything that I just said wrong. All right. And it was like, why am I killing myself to learn this language that nobody wants to speak to me in?
Yeah,
now, I'm sure that if I was in the Alps and I found some 75-year-old guy, that person's only going to speak German. But, you know, in Frankfurt, you know, it's just English. And I have to, you know, since I'm from New York, I have to speak a little bit slower than I would normally. But
I think in Spain where I lived, and it was part of it was just at the time, it was the early 90s, but very few people spoke English where I lived. I lived in southern Spain in a town called Malaga. And it was probably a lot different if you'd gone to, you know, if we were living in Barcelona or Madrid. I'm sure a lot more people spoke English there, but yeah, very few people spoke English, so it forced me to learn the language.
Yeah,
which is probably which was nice in a way, because I had classmates that lived in another town where it was mostly immigrants from England, and there were certain towns where you wouldn't hear any Spanish spoken, so. For me, kind of where we live was a bit of a blessing, I guess, because it forced me to learn the language.
Sure, sure. So after high school, what was next?
Yeah, so when I got out of high school, I had a couple of options. Could have gone straight into university. I could have gone to West Point if I wanted to. And so I ended up deciding to go into the military. It was a family tradition. So my grandfather was a retired colonel from the Army. He had worked at the Pentagon for years. My father had been a military officer as well, Special Forces. So I decided to follow that family tradition and go to the military. So I served for 4 years in the U.S. Army. I was based in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Now, I was in during the Clinton administration, which meant there wasn't a whole lot going on. It was prior to 9/11. So I was spared combat, certainly would have served and gone into combat if I were asked to. My dad, I remember as a kid, always saying, you don't want to go into combat. The horrors of war are terrible. So he had served in Vietnam, heavy combat. So spared from that, but still nonetheless, really pushed myself mentally, physically, to parts that were very uncomfortable at times. For example, I spent 3 months in the Arctic Circle living in a tent, wood burning.
What'd you do wrong?
Did something wrong. It was great. That was a great experience. Yeah, I got to see the Northern Lights. I'd always read about the Northern Lights. You can read about the Northern Lights, but it's very different when you get to see it in person.
Yeah.
I'd always read about these massive icebergs, and it's different when you see it in person. So that was a, it was, you know, those 3 months really pushed me to the limit in terms of my more mental endurance, you know.
Yeah, and did you spend time at Fort Drum then? Usually they train for that Arctic stuff in Fort Drum,
right? Yeah, no, we did not go to Fort Drum. The funny thing was there was very little training that was involved. It was, we got on a plane and landed in the top of Norway, and we're up in a north of a place called Tromsø, so we're way up near the Arctic Circle. We were there actually on a joint exercise with the Marine Corps, so we're training the Marines on peacekeeping operations. Anyway, not to get too far in the story, I think that, and then I had a number of deployments where, you know, I was paratrooper as well, so did, I think I had 58 jumps by the time I got out. So, you know, testing my fear. I have a fear of heights, so it was kind of funny. Fear of heights forced myself to jump out of an airplane. And, you know, it was funny. Even people always ask me, did you get used to it? And I said, no, the 58th jump, I was just as nervous as the first one. So it's never, if you're afraid of heights, it's never easy jumping out of an airplane and, you know, trusting your parachute.
Well, it can't be easy anyway. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, you just jump out and, you know, that's it, you know, it's untethered. So you got out of the military. Now, you know, looking at your profile, you've had a steady stream of engagements where you're involved in supply chain of organizations. So how did you get oriented towards supply chain and find that that's going to be where you're going to apply your skills or hone your skills?
Yeah, a lot of it was luck. I had taken a course in my undergraduate studies at Auburn on logistics. Had really no clue what logistics was. And so I took a course, introductory course. It was kind of an overview. So you got into transportation, you know, understood the different modes of transportation, the principles of warehousing and distribution. This was before the big days of e-commerce. So Amazon had just launched and they were still focused mostly on books. So for me, it was that introductory course. I liked what I studied, and I thought, well, this seems interesting. One of my professors that I talked to, I said, hey, what are your thoughts on a career in logistics? And he said, well, I think it's a smart move because, and then he started talking about supply chain, which at the time, not many people were using the term supply chain. It was still looked at as mostly logistics. And so he started talking about the future of supply chain. Anyway, he gave me a few articles to read. And so as I read up, I thought, wow, this is going to be a great need in the future. And really, there were two driving factors. One, it was the continued offshoring of manufacturing. So the need to have people that were highly competent in importation of goods back into the U.S. The other factor was the emergence or the future emergence of e-commerce. So a lot of the analysts at the time were saying, hey, e-commerce is going to become a massive way that people conduct business. And because of that, you're going to have people that understand supply chain. So really it was understanding there was a future demand and low supply for those types of opportunities. That led me to enroll in my master's program at the University of Tennessee. Tennessee at the time had the number one program in the nation for supply chain. They're typically in the top, you know, three or four. And so I ended up going to school at Tennessee because I thought, if I'm going to go learn this, let's go to the best school out there, the school that's got the most notoriety. So ended up going and getting my master's with a concentration in supply chain logistics. So that's what really got me into the business was it actually started with just an introductory course, asking a few questions. And after reading some articles, recognized, hey, let me go all in on this and learn it the best I can.
Yeah. When you got involved in supply chain, what was the mid-1990s, I would guess?
It was early 2000s. So
early 2000s? Okay.
2001.
Because, you know, supply chains as we know them today really didn't start until, you know, 1990.
Yeah.
You know, with China entering into the World Trade Organization. And, you know, it was funny. I remember Ross Perot talking about the giant sucking sound into Mexico. And, it, you know, that never materialized. It just bypassed Mexico and went right to China. Yeah. You know, the complexity, and I'm sure that you'll speak to that in a moment, the complexity of the supply chains. I think that, we underestimated, people underestimated in general, in businesses, the complexity of the supply chain as you go further afield. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1990 and before, your entire supply chain was like within a 2-hour drive of the plant that was going to consume it. Right. And now we're like, you know, 60 days at sea or whatever it is from point to point. And, you know, there's a lot of that can go wrong in 60 days. Not to mention, if you get a whole container of stuff that's not good, what do you do with it, right? I mean, you know, it's impossible to rectify it. And I would imagine that complexity was amplified over COVID because you couldn't inspect it before it was put on the container.
Right.
You know what I mean? At least before you could have inspectors there and say, yeah, this is a good product. We're going to put it on the container and off it goes. But, you know, if you can't inspect it, you have to do it on faith, and faith, you know, trust but verify, right?
Absolutely.
So what were some of the challenges along your way? I mean, you had a series of different positions at different companies, mm-hmm. you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 150 type companies, you know, some significant enterprises. What are some of the experiences that you had? I mean, to the extent that you could share.
Yeah, I'll start with, I'll start with just a really quick experience. This was actually in grad school. So in Tennessee, you had to do a summer internship. And so I had a number of offers. I ended up deciding to go work for a company called Seagate Technology. They made hard drives at the time. So they're still around. Yeah. They had taken themselves private when I was there to restructure. So anyway, the experience there was great because I had a chance to go down to Mexico. So we had a Maquila Adora operation. So we had a factory, you know, across the border in Mexico, and then we had another location in McAllen, Texas, across the border. So we'd feed raw materials into the factory. The factory would create semi-finished goods, and we'd bring it back into the U.S. and then make the finalized hard drives and then ship out all over the world. And so for that experience was great because I got to look at what I've been learning in the classroom and then apply it to global trade. Which is really the reason I bring that story up is that's what propelled me to make a decision on my offer coming out of grad school. I had 5 or 6 different offers, and I chose Home Depot because Home Depot wanted an international supply chain analyst to help them start looking at their direct import program. So when I joined Home Depot, I immediately started traveling to China. So I've been traveling to China on and off, you know, since 2002, 2003. And so I got a chance to go visit factories there at a very young age in my career. It was a great opportunity for me and something that really kind of set the course for my career progression. So Depot spent a ton of time focusing on direct imports, looking at lead time variability, how that impacted our inventory levels and in stocks at our stores. When I was at Home Depot, we were opening 300 plus stores a year at the peak when I was there. Almost a store a day. And these stores on the average back then carried 55,000 stock keeping units or items. And so the complexity, when you think about importing product from, I think, 47 countries at the time that I was there into, you know, 3,500 stores across the US, Canada was highly complex. So I learned the importance of metrics and simplification of what was being done. The other piece I got exposure to there, I randomly one day I was in Washington, D.C. doing some work with a lobbyist group up there called RILA, Retail Industry Leaders Association. We were looking at ways to secure cargo. This was after 9/11, the time the Senate went to push through a bill that would require the ports to open every container and scan them, which it's anyone's been to a port, they know that's physically impossible. I think last time I read, I think less than 1% of goods are physically examined as they come in the country. And so did a lot of education of our leaders up in Washington, D.C. for about a year. Anyway, while I was up there one day, I'd been reading in a paper, a Wall Street Journal, that talked about China moving from a pegged currency to the dollar to a floating basket of currencies. Well, I'm not a finance guy, but I thought, well, wow, that sounds like that could drive some inflation in the supply chain. So I was still young enough at the time that I didn't care if I looked dumb. I thought, look, I'm going to go take this to the head of sourcing and see what he has to say. We had a conversation and his feedback was, yeah, we're not doing any hedging. This could drive some inflation. Feel free to do some work on it and come back to me. So I ended up partnering with The Economist, looked at some risk models they had, some outlooks. Anyway, we worked with the Treasury to do some hedging. So we were doing some things around buying commodities, selling it back to our suppliers to basically hedge from a currency fluctuation standpoint. But it was a great opportunity in my career to step a little bit outside my comfort zone or my lane, address something that was still somewhat related to the supply chain, but it was monetary issue, and understand how to drive and maintain and mitigate risk. So it was a great opportunity. I was really appreciative. My time at Depot was great because I had a chance to do a lot of different things there, and really kind of understand what it was that I was passionate about. And for me, what I realized, it was global supply chain, dealing with factories globally and elongated supply chains because of the complexity and the importance of managing the complexity and risk.
So in all of this, did you ever have anything blow up on you?
Oh, yeah. Plenty of times. I had a situation. I can't go too deep in the situation, but I had a situation one day where someone asked me they said, "Hey, have you looked at CNN? And I said, "No, I haven't looked at it today." And I said, "Go to CNN.com and pull it up." So I did. And on the front of CNN.com, there was a logo of the company with a marijuana leaf on top of it. And it turned out that one of the customers at one of the stores had bought a bathroom vanity. And when they opened it up, there were drugs in it. And so immediately worked with customs. We ended up going inspecting factories. And in the end of it, we found out it was being introduced outside of our control in the supply chain. But again, it showed the risk out there in supply chains that you've got to actively be monitoring. And there's going to be risk that are introduced when you have multiple handoff of goods cross borders. So it was a
good lesson. And you're only inspecting 1%, right? I mean, they're exactly. They're just playing the odds, and they're crafty little buggers down there that try to import those pharmaceuticals. They're not too kind either.
It ended up, I guess, somewhat way of blessing in disguise because it caused us to really start to put better parameters of security in the supply chain. We got involved with a program called CTPAT, which was a program designed to help protect the flow of commerce and yeah. mitigating things coming in the country. Anyway, those types of learnings were invaluable when I think about my career.
When you think about the supply chains and the number of variables and their permutations, it's mm-hmm. Every day it's something new. I mean, and I think that's what I would be fascinated by in the supply chain is that it's ever evolving. Mm-hmm. In fact, we look at the supply chain challenges that we had over the last, few years, and it's only because they've never been stress tested like they had been over the years. And, people are, surprised by the lack of elasticity that existed. And I also think that was also because people were having one-to-one relationships. They didn't have any backup suppliers. And I think this will give us an opportunity for doing a fundamental rethink of supply chain and logistics. And the outcome will probably be an improved, resilience of the supply chain, if you will.
I think so. There's a lot of talk, and now it's more than talk, it's action, but you are seeing some nearshoring. When I was at Apple, we brought production of the Mac Pro to Austin, Texas. That was over 10 years ago. So that was a move. And then you've probably seen recently in the news where Apple is now producing iPhones in India for non-India consumption. So it's kind of the first time they've done that. They have manufacturing in Brazil, but that was for Brazilian consumption there. A lot of that was for taxation reasons. But I think you're going to see more nearshoring. It's funny, for years people talked about nearshoring. I think it took a catastrophic event like what we went through to make people realize, no, you really have to have some type of nearshoring component because it's just way too risky to have everything in one location that far away.
Yeah. I've been in Monterrey, Mexico several times and, highly industrialized, highly capable geography or, region. And it's only a couple hours from the U.S. border. So you can really quite literally get closer to just in time mm-hmm. as opposed to having ships at sea.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there. The other trend I've seen outside of manufacturing in the U.S. is at least having companies moving away from just in time. So there's not you still don't want to stack up an incredible amount of inventory, but trying to do things just in time with with a, I think the big thing that got people, if you look historically, your average lead time from say Shanghai into, you know, factory outside of Shanghai into a distribution center in Southern California was, you know, 30 to 45 days at most. And we saw during the pandemic that that number got up to 125, 130, 140 days, which is, you know, you when you think about that lead time and the variability of it, we're just now seeing those lead times finally come back to somewhat normal. But we're still, when we track today, we're still seeing lead times of 60 plus days from Asia into the U.S. So we're still not back to pre-pandemic levels of lead time.
Right. So you had here, what was your most valuable failure in your career?
Yeah, I'd say the most valuable failure was actually when I was at Kimberly-Clark. So at Kimberly-Clark, I'd been tasked with looking at ways to globalize our logistics procurement or procurement of logistics services. So when I joined Kimberly-Clark, the company had been around for about 128 years, had grown heavily through acquisitions. So the company had made a number of acquisitions to grow around the U.S. or grow around the globe. And so we basically had, I think at the time we had five or six regions globally, but then under each of those regions, you had multiple countries. So in many cases, you had each country procuring its own services in regards to logistics. The reason that was a bit problematic is when you looked at the global footprint of the company, and then you did an overlay of the provider base around that, what you saw was that one, we had way too many providers. And then two, in some cases, you had the same provider servicing us in every single region, in some cases, every country, but on its own contract. And so what we recognized was we needed ways to leverage our global spend. The other piece was not just the cost side of it, but it was service. So having that many different disparate providers caused a lot of challenges from maintaining a similarity in service offerings. And so I approached this the wrong way, which was a good lesson for me. As I came into the opportunity, I was super eager and passionate to help make an impact and help us globalize our footprint. What I failed to do was actually take those lessons that I learned in Spain when I lived there about cross-cultural communication. So language is use it or lose it, but I'd also say thinking about cross-cultural communication is kind of a use or lose as well, because I had really approached it more like an imperialistic kind of manner. So I came to the table and said, hey, we're going to globalize our spend. This is what we're going to do. So I didn't, there was no listening going on my part. It was a lot of talking and telling people what we were going to do. Most people were very friendly and they smiled and nodded their head. And, you know, the minute I turned around and left, they went back to working the way they had previously. So we got about 6 or 7 months into the new contract period. I'm getting all these complaints from the service providers that our different affiliate companies weren't honoring the agreement that we signed. And so I had to go back and ask a lot of questions. I had a really good mentor at the time that said, hey, ask me, didn't tell me anything, just asked me a lot of questions. Hey, what? How could you have approached this? Why are people not doing what they committed to? And the Socratic exercise of doing a lot of you know, deep reflection. And basically what I recognized was, I didn't handle it in a partnership manner. I tried to come at it from my point of view, and I didn't let people, you know, engage enough in the process. I didn't show up what's in it for them. So I had to go back and very humbly admit my faults to the group, basically, you know, say, look, I did not approach this the right way. And I recognized that we need to work together as one team. And so this is kind of where this one team philosophy I talk about a lot came up. I recognized the power of one team, and it's a conversation. It's not a monologue. So for me, it was bring people in quickly, you know, let them understand what the burning platform is, but then give people a chance to help influence the vision and how you get there. And when I took that approach, we had a much different outcome. Still took about 3 years to get fully formed and running like we were supposed to, but year two was much better than year one because we started working together as one team.
So, two questions I have there. I want to, the first question I have is, why did they sign up for it if they knew they weren't going to be able to deliver? Okay. So that, you know, in your first meetings. And the second thing, thing I wanted you to delve into is what is one team?
So the first part of the question, why did they sign up? There was an edict kind of from the top down that we were going to globalize what we were doing from a supply chain logistics standpoint. So I think in theory, they said, okay, yep, we got to do this. I think in practice, you know, kind of when I said people started going back to the way they were working previously, there were kind of two things. I think one, they were testing the system to see, okay, well, I think there maybe been initiatives in the past where there was something that maybe came from the top down. The regions said they kind of bought into it and then didn't do it and then nothing happened. So I think part of it was just testing to see, okay, is the company serious? Do we really want to globalize? That to me, I think the reason there was not a lot of conflict up front, some of it was cultural as well. I think there were a number of these countries that still saw the U.S. as the parent company and said, okay, we don't want to create conflict with the parent company. So we'll politely say we're going to get on board and then we'll see if they really hold us to it. That was my take on it. I think there were certain countries that I think understood the vision and they were somewhat bought in, but again, they were, they felt like they were not being, asked what we should be doing. And so at some point they waned, their interest levels waned as well. That was my take. One team for me is a culture. So it's you never arrive there. I was just talking to my team the other day about this. We talk a lot about one team. We've been talking about it for the year that I've been here. And we've made a lot of progress, but it's one of those things that if you don't use it, you lose it. So you've got to be thinking and acting like a one team member every day. It means having empathy. It means having a dialogue instead of a monologue. It means not constricting yourself to one lane. For example, I have a gentleman that historically has focused on inbound transportation, and then we got him engaged in helping with the outbound transportation because we've had some layoffs, and so he's stepped up. And you know, that was my call out the other day to the team. It's, hey, this is a great role model of someone that's thinking outside of just their function or their lane. They're here helping their teammates out when their teammates need help.
Good. And where did you develop the one team, or is this something you developed or something you learned along your way? Or
yeah, I think I learned the concepts along the way when I read a lot. And you know, early in my career, I was really fascinated with who are some of the most capable leaders throughout history and what made them tick. You know, what were the commonalities? So I read a number of biographies, read a lot of different business books, whether it was Jack Welch or the story of Alan Mulally at Ford. That's actually one of my favorite books, a book called American Icon. That book probably had the most influence on me in my career when I think about one team, because it talks about a situation where Alan Mulally had been the COO at Boeing. He comes into Ford in the kind of the early 90s, early 2000s. Ford's in dire shape. They're losing 10 plus billion a year. And he came in and created this operating system and operating rhythm that really drove a one team focus. And so I think studying that and then fumbling around with it over time, I tried to implement this, and it was a lot of failures along the way. I think that's helped me continue in my evolution. Certainly, I'm not a master at it. And I'd say you don't ever arrive, but it's something that I learned along the way from reading about and then doing.
Yeah, I remember a couple of anecdotes of Macaulay coming onto Ford. The first was how complex the Ford products were, and they were, you know, the board was questioning, are you able to, you know, handle such complex, you know, we have almost 3,000 parts in our car. And it was like well, a plane's got like 40,000 parts. And the other story I heard was that he asked for a health check of the various business units and business functions, and everybody came back green. Yeah. And he's like, I know it's not all green. I mean, we need to know what the truth is in order for us to fix it. Nobody's going to get, you know, fired for showing red, you know, they're only going to get fired if they show green and it's red. Yeah. So I thought that was
actually highly impactful for me. That specific part, anytime I come into a new organization, I use that example and I ask the team to read it. A lot of times we'll just kind of go over that part of the book. But yeah, it's funny. It's very true. It's very countercultural to show where you're failing in our society, in my opinion. And so it's getting people to think that way. And that's why companies like Toyota have done well over the years, because that they draw that from lean thinking, or the lean philosophy that was Edward Deming brought to Japan to help rebuild the country after World War II. But that thinking is countercultural. And so it takes people a while to recognize, oh, I am safe to actually bring my red. By the way, but the leader sets the tone. If you yell at people when they have something in the red, they're going to, people are, generally speaking, humans are going to protect themselves, and they're going to sugarcoat it or put things in the yellow, I find. So it's not quite red, it's yellow. But it's, you know, for me, I don't like yellow, I like red or green. It's either, you're either achieving or you're not.
Yeah, exactly right. Or it's not started. I mean, right. you could also be black. You know, if black is not started, it's either green for go or red for, we got a problem here. And, you know, and I agree with you, it's cultural. When I was a young kid, my father told me that if I ever am the smartest person in the room, I'm in the wrong room. And, you know, and he expanded upon that, of course. It's like, you know, you have to understand what you're capable of, but you have to more understand what you're not capable of and get those people on board your team. You know, and this gets back to your one, you know, one team concept. It's like, you know, there's no I in team, right? I mean, that's just the way there is. Yeah. So excellent. So you talked about books and historical figures. So what? And we just talked about one book, but what are some of the readings that you would recommend? Some of the leaders of past or even present that you look up to now.
Yeah, you know, I'll start with like a U.S. president, Teddy Roosevelt, fascinating individual, learned a lot about his leadership style and philosophy, and also just passion for living. You look at the things he was engaged in, outdoors activities. I'm also a big outdoors enthusiast, so I'm thankful for all the national parks that we have in the U.S., which came about a lot because of his passion for nature. That's someone. I read a lot of books, and I've been influenced on Stoicism. So, you know, the writings of Marcus Aurelius. I've got a favorite author, Ryan Holiday is his name. He's written a bunch of books on Stoicism, and he's got a series of books that's out right now. Courage is Calling is one of the books that I recently read. It's a really good book. It's kind of a call to arms to step up and have courage in times right now where we need people, leaders to have courage, because there's a lot of volatility. And then I guess one of my other favorite books is definitely Principles by Ray Dalio. Ray was, you know, multi-billionaire, but highly successful in Wall Street. And he's got a book on principles. So basically he spent his life trying to perfect his thinking. So coming up with algorithms in his mind to make decisions. And it's basic logic is really what he's teaching of being logical. So I think, yeah, those books there, those leaders were highly influential. The Alan Wally book, American Icon. And then I've read a ton of books on lean thinking. So, you know, thinking about ways to leverage tools to help effectively problem solve. And that's been highly influential in how I, you know, attack problem solving and help lead in the supply chain.
One of my favorite sayings from Teddy Roosevelt, which I use often, is do what you can with what you got from where you are.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes that's just the way it is, right? I mean, hope is dope. You can't wish to start from a different place. You have to start from where you are. Yeah. So that's great. So, you know, I talk a lot about operational excellence. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's about an organization behaving and operating better as an organization, not just its parts. When you think about, you know, you mentioned Lean a couple of times. You haven't mentioned Six Sigma, but you did mention Jack Welch. And those two are almost synonymous. And operational excellence. So what are your notions on, you know, these various concepts?
Yeah, so actually, it's funny thing is when I first started learning about operational excellence, it was actually at Home Depot. At the time, Home Depot's CEO came from GE, so he was he'd been mentored by Jack Welch. So Bob Nardelli was the CEO at the time. Bob brought in Six Sigma into retail. First time it ever happened before. No one had ever tried to bring Six Sigma thinking into the retail environment. Everyone said, "Ah, it's not going to work." You know, a lot of probably not the best feelings at Home Depot that a lot of the tenured people had about Bob. He wasn't there very long, but I do think a lot of his legacy was around getting people to think, leverage statistics for problem solving and thinking about ways to run the business. So I was introduced. I spent a year in Greenbelt training, ended up doing a project that was completely outside of my area of expertise. It was around driving leads through a call center environment. And so I'd never worked in sales or a call center. So for me, it was great because I got to learn a new part of the business. I think my big learning, Six Sigma was great. I learned a lot. For me, my frustration with Six Sigma was it took us a long time to make decisions because a project, there was a rigor set around the project to say you've got to go through different toll gates. And you had a mentor there, a master black belt, that would work with you and basically coach through it. So that part was great. The challenge I saw was it took like over a year to get my project implemented. By the time we were ready to go, the environment had changed quite a bit. We had lost a lot of time. Contrast that with lean thinking, which I learned at Kimberly Clark. So when I joined Kimberly Clark, the company had been really focused on reducing its manufacturing footprint and getting more efficient, shedding assets that weren't getting the return they needed. And so what I learned there was lean thinking, which was really learned by doing. So we started small with a couple introduction of a couple of tools, started getting people to leverage those tools in their day-to-day problem solving. And what I found there was we were able to move much quicker and have less bureaucracy when it came to decision-making and problem solving. So I won't go too deep into that, but I will say that the lean way of thinking to me is incredibly powerful. I find a lot of people get scared off at first because when they hear the term lean, they think it's overly complex and complicated. And I'd say actually it's the opposite. I always tell people if you can't explain what you're trying to solve in one or two sentences, you should go back and reconsider what the problem is, because if you don't have that level of clarity, you're likely not going to be able to get to a proper root cause and countermeasure that's going to fix the issue.
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges when people are implementing lean is they go, they introduce some of the most complex concepts first, mm-hmm. instead of, basic blocking and tackling, start with 5S and quick changeover. Yeah. I mean, if you could just work on those two things, then everything else will start falling in place. But I think sometimes people want to go too far too fast. And they overwhelm the people they're trying to affect and bring on board, and you get lackluster results as a consequence.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I find from my perspective, when I come into a new organization that hasn't been introduced to lean thinking, I try to start with just basic problem solving or problem definition, and right. literally have. And sometimes people are like, "Are you really? We're going to go through this exercise?" I'm like, "Yeah, you need to get trained to think quickly to say, okay, again, if I can't explain my current condition or problem I'm trying to solve in one or two sentences, I probably don't have enough clarity of what's going on. So I need to go back and get some more data and analyze further." So I tend to take it from that approach. I've seen companies that try to, and I've actually been guilty of this myself at times, where they bring too many tools to the table. So you start talking about a fishbone diagram with 5 whys, and then you're trying to do an A3 form. And when you try to introduce all this at once, it confuses people, and you have to be patient. I think that's probably one of the challenges why some companies haven't continued to embrace lean thinking. Is it's a journey, it's a marathon. You're not gonna even when I was at Kimberly Clark, it took us 5 years to start hitting our stride. And I remember that we had some lean senseis that came over from Japan, and their feedback is Toyota's been doing this for 70 years, and they're 30% of the way. Their point was that this doesn't happen overnight. By the way, you don't do lean. I've also heard people say, "Oh, we're gonna start doing lean." It's like, well, no, you don't do lean. Lean's a culture. It's kind of like one team. It's a culture and a way of thinking and a way you attack or approach problem solving.
Right. I think that another challenge practitioners have is that we assume too much. Mm-hmm. We assume that it's so obvious and so crystal clear and so native to us that it should be that way to everybody else. And we start talking about the how and the what without talking about the why first. Why are we doing this? Why is this important? Why should you be on board? Get the context, draw the people in first so that they understand that this is not about the company. It's not about somebody else. It's about them and improving their circumstances. And they're injecting or hopefully injecting some joy into their job. Yeah. Or at least if you can't inject joy, at least remove pain, right? Yeah. Which is almost the same thing. So
some of it's trust too. what I've learned in the past is when you start talking about a big change management of, hey, we're gonna pivot to lean thinking and operating in a lean manner. Unfortunately, a lot of times when people hear that, they think, oh, layoffs. You're going to automate my job, or you're going to dumb it down enough where you can offshore it. And so I think companies have to be careful about making sure that when you think about embarking on the journey, it's not about getting rid of people. In fact, if you look at a lot of companies like Toyota, what they pride themselves in is as you automate things or as you simplify work, you get people to work on higher value added type activities that require a lot more of the mental thinking than the kind of the tactical doing. So that's the way I think about it. And that's why I think it's important for leaders to slow down and tell them the why. The why is, hey, we need you to work on stuff that are much harder problems to solve than, dealing with this one thing over here that could be automated or potentially offshored.
All right. So, being if you're a futurist, where do you see either the discipline or industry or supply chain going in the near term, in the next three or five years, say?
I think 3 to 5 years, you'll see some more nearshoring. I don't think anybody would predict that we would never be reliant on manufacturing out of China. I think they're always going to have a manufacturing base. But I do think we'll start to see more nearshoring, or at least availability to supply closer to our borders. So I think that one that will hopefully help drive down some of the complexity and also reduce some of the volatility we've seen with product availability. I think on the discipline itself, I do think you're going to continue to see artificial intelligence, machine learning, more data science being pulled into the industry itself or the field. And you're going to see a lot more ways to think about problem solving that haven't been capable in the past. I think one of the big challenges still with e-commerce is inventory placement and being able to get your inventory as close to the consumer as you can without stockpiling a ton of safety stock. Companies still struggle with that today. When you think about replenishing, say, 1,500 stores in a retail big box network versus shipping to, I don't know how many zip codes we have in the U.S., but probably over, hundreds of thousands of zip codes. It's much more challenging the latter part of being able to get that right. But as we want to continue to move to e-commerce, we're going to have to rely on things like machine learning to help us with our inventory management and being able to get product closer to the consumer so you don't have these long transit times or having to upgrade shipments to get stuff to people quicker.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes about, machine learning and artificial intelligence, because I think about this article I read in, I think it was Apex magazine in the 1990s. Okay. So I'm getting into Dr. Whoopi's Wayback Machine here, but, and that's even a Wayback Machine reference, but there was, Volvo made these cars, and there was a particularly ugly green color that didn't sell particularly well. And in America, the dealers were giving discounts to people to unload these cars. All right. Mm-hmm. So what happened in Sweden is that they saw a spike in the sale of these green cars. So what'd they do? They made more.
Made more.
Okay. So, we have to be careful, I think, about when we think about these algorithms and machine learning, that we have to understand that context is important.
Absolutely.
And what concerns me sometimes is that we're going to look at the surface of the data and not see through to the context. And next thing you know, everybody's going to have ugly green cars that we're driving around in.
Yeah, I think a good analogy on that too is something my dad had taught me, but I think the late Colin Powell said it best. He said in wartime, the commander in the field is always assumed to be right until proven wrong. And so your point on context, so the reason I bring that analogy up is you've got to really understand kind of on the front lines what's going on. To your point, if you're only sitting in a corporate office and you're looking at data, but you don't have any context of what's happening in the field or on the ground, you're not going to be very effective. And so that's something that I'm always deliberate about when I start a new role is I want to spend my first 90 days in the field. I want to be with people. I want to be in the manufacturing centers or the fulfillment centers, distribution centers. And actually just observing, because there's so much power that comes from walking a floor. You don't have to talk to anybody, but just walking around, you're going to be able to understand, okay, the dynamics. Is leadership engaged there with their shop floor associates? I can typically tell within 5 minutes if there's good engagement between leadership and shop floor associates just by walking around and how they interact with one another.
Absolutely.
Highly important, highly important.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Ben, listen, thanks a lot for spending some time with me today. I really appreciate your wisdom and sharing with me and my audience your story. It's been really great.
Well, Joe, thanks so much. I love your show and I'll continue to follow it. And I'm really honored that you afforded me the time to be on the show today. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.